Hi, I'm Guy English.
And I'm Renee, and welcome to Debug. And Guy, this is the first week that we actually have sponsors on the show.
It is. Sort of a change of pace.
So do you want to know who our first sponsor is?
I'd love to know who the first sponsor is.
It's Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/debug and enter offer code debug, that's D-E-B-U-G, at checkout. A better web starts with your website.
So our second non-official sponsor is ATP.FM. Accidental Tech Podcast. Those guys need all the help they can get.
Yeah, visit them if you haven't already. So one more thing before we get started, Guy. You wanted to say something about WWDC Girls.
I did. There's a very great event being put on called WWDC Girls. And you can get tickets at the URL that we're going to put in the show notes. But this is going to kill me to read this out loud. The URL is www.wwdcgirls.org.
And, well done.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I didn't screw that one up.
Nope.
And you can sponsor the event. You can buy tickets to go to it. It's a noble cause. And I think, anybody, if you're listening to the show and you've been sort of enjoying it, please consider attending this event or sponsoring in some way.
Yeah, or I did both, so please consider doing both too.
Always a good idea.
Yep. And now our guest for today, Rich Siegel of Barebone Software. Rich, how did you get into computers? How did you get your hands on the first one?
Oh my goodness. I remember when I was 8 years old and I visited my sisters. They were in college up in Boston, Cambridge, actually. And I roomed with one of my sisters, and her boyfriend took me over to the Harvard University Science Center, where they had I didn't know what it was at the time, of course, but it was an HP Mini, a 2000 running BASIC for a multi-user system. And I was eight, so he set me down in front of this thing that looked enough like a typewriter for me to recognize it, and it had this huge box of paper underneath it, and he started typing commands into it, and it started doing things. And he said, "Okay, here's what you do." And he set me down in front of some simple games, one of which was Hunt the Wumpus.
Nice.
Which I still remember. And that was my first remembered contact with actual computers. And it wasn't really until a couple of years later that I actually did anything that looked like programming. I did a summer program through the school district, and it was a similar thing. They set us in front of again, coincidentally, an HP Mini and a deck writer and an acoustic coupler. And we learned how to dial a phone and put the handset into this funny looking device. And started typing and running simple BASIC programs. And we learned only really the few rudimentary things about programming, but nothing really advanced. But that was my first contact with computers and anything that even resembled programming.
So did you get into that course just because you liked that initial first introduction to the HP 200?
Well, I remembered it. I remembered the summer program, and I I think my parents told me that there was a summer program in computers, and I said, "Oh, well, I remember computers sort of."
Right.
So let's try that. It was fun, so let's do it again.
Right, that's cool.
And so I had that positive first experience, and that sort of made me disposed towards doing it again.
Yeah, that's great. Must have been fun working on those computers with an acoustic coupler back then.
It was something.
Yeah.
And
your very first computers had a notion of networking, which to me didn't come until quite a bit later.
Yeah, the acoustic coupler was more about, it was a dial-up system, right?
Right.
And so we didn't know about networking. We didn't have this concept that, that multiple computers could even be connected together. And when I was in middle school, a couple of years after all this, the school library had three Commodore PETs in it. And they just sat in a room and they weren't connected to each other at all. If you wanted to share something with somebody else, you would write it out to a cassette and pass it across the table. And that was it. The notion of computers being networked as such, you know, just didn't come to my awareness until somewhat later. I didn't have firsthand experience with networked computers until I went off to college.
That makes sense. I'm reminded, because you mentioned the tapes, I'm reminded of this story. My friend from Poland told me that they, in the 80s, they would have radio stations that would just broadcast software over the air, because they would basically take the tape and play it over the air. And so if you got lucky, you could manage to record your software.
Oh, that's great. And I never heard of anything like that, but that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, I loved it. Well, I mean, on the software piracy side, not so cool, but on the awesome hack side, I think it's awesome.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So you didn't get to do networking stuff until... let me rewind a bit. Where did you go from there?
Well, let's see. So in high school, I took computer science, as they called it. And it was more programming. It was more basic, more AppleSoft basic this time, on Apple IIs. But also I came into contact with the computers at the college that was in the town I grew up in. And that was a considerably more powerful machine. That was a Prime mini computer, but it also shared the campus machine room with a big old IBM mainframe and a couple of other things. And the Prime was something. Mm-hmm. Prime ran Emacs, and the Prime had an advanced Pascal compiler on it, and the Prime had Fortran. And so I found myself doing a lot more programming and a lot more interesting things on it.
That's interesting. So, I mean, you'd come up with BASIC. Where did you go after that? Did you try Pascal or Fortran first?
Yeah. Well, I went from BASIC through some Fortran and into Pascal. Mm-hmm. And on my first exposure to Pascal, I just didn't get it.
Right.
But then I read some books. I took a course at their local college when I was, I think it was a junior or senior in high school, and it was Intro to CS, and it was taught in Pascal. And then I got it.
Yeah, that's good help. I had a hard time getting the Pascal myself, and C just totally confused me.
Yeah, C, my first exposure to C was in college, and I realized that it was a pretty efficient way to generate core dumps.
Yes.
No matter what you were doing.
You could get a core dump pretty much in
core dump.
Right.
But eventually I figured it out. I figured out the syntax. I figured out the rules and still did an awful lot of my programming in Pascal, but I was able to get my head around C. And a few years later when I went off to my first job, even though I was still doing mostly Pascal, I started doing a lot of programming in really both languages, Pascal and C. I learned assembly language on the job, 68,000 assembly language, and that was an adventure.
I bet. Yeah. So what was the job?
So my first job was doing technical support at a software company called Think Technologies. And Think is a name that very few people recall these days.
Think C and Think Pascal.
But they were the folks, that's right, they were the folks who did, in the day they were called Lightspeed C and Lightspeed Pascal. Mm. And just before then, Think did, under license for Apple, did a Pascal interpreter called Macintosh Pascal. And Lightspeed Pascal kind of grew out of that, and Lightspeed C was developed in parallel. And so I started doing technical support there, and doing tech support for compilers is it's a thing, right? Because first of all, it was all done on the telephone. There was no, this was 1987, 88. And this was, pre-internet. People would call in and they would have questions.
This seems like an impossible task. Like nobody would try it these days.
Well, yeah, it was something. And fortunately, a lot of what it came down to was people would call in and they'd say, I'm trying to do this and it doesn't work. And their first hypothesis was there was a bug in the compiler. There was a bug in, what they called our libraries, which were really the interfaces to the OS toolbox, or some other nebulous thing was wrong. And oddly, the first hypothesis was never, I'm doing something wrong.
Right. Of course not. Why would you think that?
But it sort of became clear that there were sort of these canonical mistakes that folks would make. They would forget to call init graph in mm-hmm. the old Mac toolbox, or they would forget to set something up correctly, or they would pass a bad argument. And so when it came right down to it, it really wasn't terribly hard to support. Once in a while, sure enough, yes, there would right. be legitimate bugs in the compiler, or there would be a bug in the IDE, although of course we didn't call them that back then. And so that sort of kept things interesting. But Think had really good engineering and Think had really good QA. So the quantity of actual bugs that would make it out the door and into the field was pretty low.
That's really just diving in the deep end, and that's going to have to help you understand the OS and the toolbox APIs and everything incredibly well, because you're just seeing everybody else's mistakes.
It did at the time, and so I started out doing support, and in the Mac industry, at least at the time, it seemed like that was kind of the progression. You'd start off doing tech support, and advancement meant moving to QA, mm-hmm. where you would start doing testing and, writing test cases and verifying correctness and things like that. And then you would move into engineering. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that is the progression that I followed. And so I ended up, my first actual engineering job involved writing floating point math routines. I think it was printf for the new version of ThinkC that we were working on at the time.
Oh, that's fine.
And talk about getting thrown into the deep end.
Right.
you get handed basically a specification. And say, okay, this needs to work this way.
I bet. So no math coprocessors at the time, I'm
not
assuming?
Not at the time. There were the Mac 2 was out. This is 87, 88, 89. The Mac 2 was out, but, they were pretty expensive machines and not very many people had them.
Yeah, even on the PC side, you couldn't rely on that for like a long time. Like the 386, I think maybe it was the first one to integrate a floating point unit. Because the 387, I know the 287.
Yeah, the 287 was outboard, and then the 386 came along, and it might have had floating point on board,
which is pretty late. So.
Right, so you couldn't rely on a math coprocessor. You couldn't. So what we did we wrote interfaces to the Apple, the OS supply math library called SANE, the standard Apple numeric environment.
I bet it wasn't SANE.
Surprisingly, it was well named. It was pretty well thought out and it worked very well. And that was the thing was Apple. And I don't know where this came from, but Apple decided or had a mandate that they needed to implement IEEE standards compliant numerics, and they did, and it worked.
That's good.
So a lot of it was glued to SANE, and there were some things like printf, which SANE didn't do number formatting; it only did representations in math.
Yeah,
and so that was That was a real eye opener, and I can't say that it was the most fun I had, but I did learn a lot. And from there on, things just sort of progressed. I would write features, and I would debug things, and I did a lot of work on Lightspeed Pascal. I remember fixing it so that it would work on under System 7 virtual memory. This is in 1990.
Wow.
And you know, that was another trial by fire. That was a lot of assembly language work to deal with things that were happening at exception time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all in the, not the callback, but the request line goes up and you have to take care of it.
Right. That's right. And so what would happen is we had exception handlers, and the stack frame looked different depending on whether virtual memory was running or not. Yeah. And the stack frame would look different depending on whether you were running a coprocessor or not. And it was really a different world. Really, right. Really was very different from writing GUI code, or really even different from writing the code generator. I did some work on that as well. And you know, the compiler engineers would say, here, you know, we need you to fix this bug in which the compiler would generate the wrong code for array indexing with a 32-bit index.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me that because it was something I needed to understand and learn how to do. And they wanted me to get my head around it and figure it out. And so that things like that was, things like that were where I got my knowledge of the instruction set.
Right.
Yeah. You know, not just by reading and debugging it, but by actually generating instructions.
Yeah. Now, so I can see that being super challenging, but at least you get to compare your work sort of statically, right? Like one iteration of the code generated can be different than the other one. You can see where you've screwed up, you've made a change.
That's right. And I can sort of know instantly whether I've done it right or not.
Right. But dealing with these exceptions, like these paging exceptions, basically these faults, that's more of a real-time environment. Like you're having to react to the state the machine's in at any given time.
It is a little bit, you know, having a good machine level debugger really did help at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they existed, right? Maxbug, by that point was pretty good. And we also used a debugger called Tmon.
Oh yeah. I've heard of that. Yeah.
Which was terrific. That sort of rapidly became everyone's favorite.
Right.
I think the guy who wrote it's actually at Google now. incredibly smart guy.
Yeah, I bet. So we should explain what VM meant to Macs rather than Unix machines. Because it's different. Like we're, you know, you have handles and a whole bunch of other stuff going on for a Mac VM, a classic Mac VM.
Well, right. Before OS X, you know, Macs didn't have a Unix memory system, right? They didn't have the concept of a pager, really. So the Mac memory model was shared. The memory space was shared across the entire machine,
right.
And every process was cooperatively tasked. So you shared resources with the whole machine, and you knew you were sharing resources with the whole machine. There was no memory bounce protection. So if you wrote something off the end of a block, if you were lucky, you would only stop something in your own heap space.
Right. Yeah.
But if you were unlucky, you'd stomp something in low memory and bring the whole machine down.
Yeah.
Or in high memory and garbage your screen, or you know, lots of really strange and unpleasant things could happen.
Right. I mean, like in a way, the OS was the only thing kind of really running, and everything else is kind of a plug-in, all into the same memory space.
Yeah, in a real sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in order to sort of manage this chaos, the OS from really the very beginning. Even before it was called the Mac OS, but from the very beginning, the OS had this concept of relocatable memory blocks.
Right.
And so,
which is brilliant and pretty far thinking if you're going to go back to like 1984 to think about that.
Absolutely. And so they would, of course the notion of a pointer was very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And so, relocation was handled by creating this new abstraction, a pointer to a pointer, which was known as a handle. So if you wanted memory from the system, you'd make a request to allocate a block of memory, and it was given back to you as a handle, which is just a double indirected pointer. And it worked. It worked really well. It created certain challenges because you could not assume that any given memory block would stay in the same place,
right,
across calls to the normally the higher level APIs.
Yeah. So when you wanted to reuse a handle, you would, I forget the name of the function, but you would basically ask the handle for its underlying pointer.
So
that process would flip the memory around in order to get access to you, right?
Well, not so much. Handles really were indirected.
Okay.
And they really were pointers to pointers. So you could just, you know, you could just throw an extra star in front of a pointer reference to.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought you had to lock them. I thought you had to.
Well, see, and this is where it started to get complicated.
Okay.
you had to lock a handle block if you took the address of something inside of it.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And you needed that address to remain valid across the call to the OS.
Got it. Okay.
Now, generally, that was the case. There were situations in which you could lock handle blocks and know that they, or that you could use handle blocks and know that they wouldn't move around certain low level functions. IO was allowed, but the picture at interrupt time was pretty ugly, because one thing that could happen is that at interrupt time, your heap could be in the middle of being rearranged.
Right.
So you needed to be aware of that. So, you know, but by and large, to application programmers, it was just sort of one of those things you learned how to do, right? It's like a driver learning how to not grind the gears when you're shifting.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's just one of those things you learn. And Mac programmers learned it, or they didn't. And if they didn't, they didn't stick around very long. That's all I had.
Okay. So most of this compiler work, were you focused on the Pascal side of the shop, or the C side? Or did it sort of interoperate a bit?
Well, so when I was working on that stuff, I did a tiny bit in the compiler, and I did some more. I did a lot of work in the IDE, and that was all on ThinkPascal. Mm-hmm. My primary engineering at Think in those days was on Lightspeed Pascal from 2.0, really through the end of life for that product.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that said, parts of Lightspeed Pascal were written in C, and right, we would use Lightspeed C. So I had lots of C work to do, and I did really very little work on Lightspeed C after the initial round of library work. But I was always in contact with those guys. You know, they were two doors down. You know, Michael Call, the guy who wrote Lightspeed C practically from scratch, the compiler practically from scratch, was, you know, two doors away, and you know, we shared offices and socialized and were friends. So,
right. How big is the company about?
When I was there, it's pretty good size. I think it was 20-30 people, give or take. It's pretty good collection of individuals. We had a good quantity of engineers. We had a functioning QA department. We had support. We had tech support. We had management. We had product marketing. The whole company was really pretty well self-contained. And in 87, in the middle of all of this time, Think got acquired by Symantec.
Mm.
And this is back in the day when Symantec actually used to do software.
Yes.
but it's funny, because Symantec was was actually formed by acquisition, and they've always been an acquisitions company. So in the late 80s and early 90s, they really put together a stellar set of product teams, which were underneath it all the companies that they had acquired.
I didn't know they started out as an acquisition kind of thing.
Yeah, they...
I knew they got into it, but that's kind of how they got on my radar as being not great.
Well, I forget the name of the company, but there were two companies, and one of them was named Symantec and bought the other, two of them merged and the new company rebranded, and that was their name. And so they did product work in house, and the companies they acquired basically became product teams. And so we were the language products group. That was our designation. And it was the same group of people that had been at Think. And then, you know, Symantec would bring in some new management, and there was kind of typical turnover, and
right.
And it worked out pretty well overall. The thing that went well with Symantec was that they had resources, and they were also pretty good about preserving the individual cultures of the companies that they acquired, so that they, the companies didn't really lose their identities once they became Symantec. Now there was a little homogenization, but,
not sure, but that doesn't necessarily, that's not a bad thing per se.
No.
So it's interesting that they sort of, you know, acquired good shops and let them continue being good shops.
Pretty much. I think where it sort of fell apart with Symantec was that they couldn't quite figure out how to move forward from there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The individual groups they had good people doing good work. In many cases, great people doing great work. And they couldn't really see their way forward from there, though. You know, this was in the early 90s, and it was a bumpy time for Apple, and a lot of companies didn't have a lot of faith that Apple was going to be around. Symantec had lines of business in both Mac and PC,
right.
And they were having a hard time justifying an investment in Mac undertakings when they couldn't see how they were going to get money back out of it.
Right. This is around the time I start to become aware of them. Maybe like Windows 95 kind of era.
Right. And so in the mid 90s, where it all sort of fell apart on the compiler side of things, on the language tool side of things, was that the compiler group wanted to do PowerPC tools.
Yeah.
And corporate said no.
Right.
And they had what was basically an exodus.
Yeah. Did everybody just go to CodeWarrior?
Almost. They lost some core. They lost some core people. In fact, the guy who had come up with it is a working design for a PowerPC code generator and said, I have this. I'd like to, you know, finish turning this into a PowerPC product.
Yeah.
There's more to do, right? You can't just generate code. You need all kinds of things to make it working IDE. But right around that time, yeah, MetroWorks was coming up, and I think they were out of Montreal, weren't they?
Some of it was, yeah.
Yeah, some of those folks were. So some key folks went to MetroWorks and started working on CodeWarrior, and by the time Symantec got the clue that maybe there was something worth pursuing there, it was too late, and they had a lot of catching up to do. And they tried, right? They hired, again, some really good people.
Mm-hmm.
But they had lost so much credibility in the community because, you know, mean, while they're trying to figure out what to do and they're saying no when everyone else is saying yes, the Mac developer community is all over PowerPC.
Right.
And what they see is that they're not getting what they need from Symantec. And so, well, here's CodeWarrior over here. And maybe it was kind of rough around the edges while they were in beta, but they were doing a public beta.
Right.
And people were using it and getting work done with it.
Yeah. And as a tools vendor, it's very hard to regain trust once you've lost it.
Yeah.
And just institutional knowledge too.
Absolutely. And, so, yeah. and it was the trust deficit that Symantec really never made up after that.
Right.
And it wasn't just tools. It was all their stuff, right? PowerPC versions of all of their products were late to the game. And, that was really kind of the beginning of the end for their Mac desktop offerings.
Yeah. In a way it's kind of short-sighted because the PowerPC, I mean, wasn't just Mac, turned out like a lot of the game developer, game platforms down the road ended up with PowerPC chips.
Yeah.
So, you know, could have been an interesting fight.
it could have been a really interesting time for everybody. And it absolutely was short-sighted of management to not get behind it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to make it clear, it was the executive management, the VP, the VPs and above who just couldn't see it.
Yeah, I can see it being a strategic decision, one that maybe they, you know, that's kind of their job. They got to make a strategic decision. And in hindsight, it looks a little bit short-sighted.
Oh, it looked short-sighted at the time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, there were a lot of really unhappy people inside the firewall.
Yeah.
At the same time, there were people in other product groups who said, you know, what are you people stupid? What are you doing?
Oh, okay. So this
PowerPC stuff really needs to happen.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't like, well, we're just going to bet on Windows and be done with it. There was a bunch of people that just felt that was not the right way to be going.
Yeah.
Good to know. Did not know that. So I forget when you say they merged, but I know that you leave, or at least Barebones has started around 93.
So, yeah. So I was at Think and Symantec from 87, 88 until 92. It's been a long time. And so BBEdit was born in the middle of all of this. Mm-hmm. It was originally a little proof of concept tool that I wrote from nothing, was where I got the code from. And,
you know, I did not know that until I did a bit of research for the show, that's where Barebones comes from. It's like it's a demo product.
That's right. It was intended to be a demo program for, a product that ended up not shipping. And, you know, I took some working pieces from other things that we had around the office. Think had shipped a library toolkit, and it was actually an editor. They called it an editor construction kit.
Mm.
And it was the editing engine that was used in Lightspeed C and Lightspeed Pascal and a few supporting libraries. And I had started out by writing the sample program, which used the OS text edit routines, but I just plugged in the editor toolkit because the APIs were by design pretty similar.
Good move. Yeah.
And it just kind of went from there because there was this need, there was some demand really just in-house starting with, for a multifunctional editor.
Right.
And so this was all happening, 89, 90. I was working on, I was working on Macintosh Pascal 3.0. Remember the original Mac Pascal interpreter that shipped in 84. So there had been a couple of versions since. And, I don't know where the idea came from, but they wanted to do a new version for some educational customers.
Okay.
And they said,
which were huge back then.
They were. There were a couple of big ones that they wanted to service. And so the product needed an update. Now, the thing about Mac Pascal was, since it had started being developed in 83, the development and tool chain landscape back then basically involved a Lisa.
Right.
So what you would do is you'd have a Lisa running the Lisa OS and Silicon Valley Systems Pascal, which is where MPW Pascal grew out of. And there was a cross compiler that would generate 68,000 code and link a Mac runtime for you.
Kind of like iOS today.
Yeah.
Not really, but it's hosted on the bigger, more expensive, more capable system, right?
Yeah. And there are a lot of similarities between the way it was done. Obviously, the technology today is so much more advanced that the experience is infinitely better. Right. But it wasn't so different. You'd build your application onto a floppy and run it on the Mac. And debugging was brutal because there was no source debugging.
Yeah.
You would run your program and it worked or it didn't. You'd debug it in MaxBug on the Mac, and iteration was painful.
I was going to say you didn't even get the caveman of programming tools, which is like printf.
Right. Yeah, and so I claim, rightly or wrongly, to be one of the last people to have ever used Elisa to ship a Mac product.
Well, let's go with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so where this is going was, I had, BBEdit 1.0 as it was. I snuck that onto the Macintosh Pascal 3.0 distribution floppies for the sole purpose of being able to read the README file that went out with Mac Pascal.
Nice.
Because the argument was I wanted to have something that people could use the README file to use to read the README file.
Was the README file greater than 32K? It sounds like maybe the audience doesn't know. Like the built-in text edit view could only look at 32K. And right. I know one of BBEdit's major features, or maybe just as editor layer, was you could blow right past that.
That's right. The OS toolbox was limited to 16 bits in the size field. That's where that limitation came from. Now I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't think it was quite that big because 32K is still a lot of text.
Still quite a bit, yeah.
For a README.
But anyway, felt good to ship your engine and have.
Right. So I was able to sneak a build of the initial BBEdit application out. And it's sort of lost in history. You know, when somebody says they've been using BBEdit since 1.0, the chances of them actually having used that particular version are pretty slim. I won't eliminate it entirely.
Yeah. But you let them have it. You're like, okay.
I slid that one out.
Yeah.
And the first couple of turns of BBEdit were free when I did public releases. The product became commercial when the resources it required were greater than I could put into it without getting paid back in some fashion.
Right.
You know, I needed to pay somebody to write documentation. I needed to pay somebody to do QA and support. And I kind of wanted to pay myself a little bit too.
Right.
So the costs became such that I started selling it.
Was there an overlap before you left Symantec?
There was. Okay. And I worked this out with them. Sort of early on, I got a letter from them that gave me the rights to this product.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious because it's probably one of the oldest going indie sort of moves.
Yeah,
where you have a product on the side and you keep working for a little bit and then you manage to break free.
That's right, and even in those days, you had to be very careful not to cross the streams because you don't want to start using code that you wrote for the office in the product that you're doing on the side, because then, A, it's not right. Unless you specifically get permission, and B, if you do that, they can reasonably make a claim to part or all of what you've done with the product.
Right.
Right. Not just the money, but the intellectual property. They can say, well, you know, you wrote this at the office and, you wrote this using our code. So the whole thing belongs to us according to this agreement that you signed when you started.
Yeah. It's got a GPL sort of sticky factor to it.
It's got a real, sticky factor to it.
And also, like you say, it's just not the right thing to be doing.
Exactly. So I was careful about not working on it at the office. And I was, you know, very careful to try to bring builds in or do the work on my own computer. If I had my own computer at the office, at least I was using my own hardware and not the office resources and so forth. So I got a letter from the company that said, yeah, this is yours. As long as you don't use any of our intellectual property, it's all yours.
And that's nice.
It was.
Companies can be jerks, but that's kind of a nice.
You know. They can be, and you know, my boss at the time really went to bat for me, and he saw that it was something that I was interested in doing, and he saw that it was going to be a really difficult sell for the to get the company interested in doing anything with it.
Right.
So it's like
you know, they would not have had it as a product. At the same time, it's worth doing as a product, just maybe not at the scale that Symantec would be interested in.
Or so aligned with their interests, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And things sort of went from there. I left Symantec in 92 and got a couple of other jobs in the middle there, but was able to really keep this thing going on the side until it gained critical mass and was actually able to pay my paycheck, which is kind of what I needed to go out full time.
And so when was that about?
That was 95.
So, Guy, we also have a second sponsor this week.
I love it.
It's Transporter. I mean, you might have heard of this if you listen to more than just one podcast. It's possible. Transporter, I think the best way to explain it is there's all these different products like Dropbox that let you store things on the cloud. But Transporter is like a personal cloud where it's a device that you own that's in your home or business on your internet connection storing your data. So if you really want to trust nobody, it is, I think, an ideal solution for that.
Yes. I'm less on the trust nobody side, and which is totally with the NSA running around rampant. Yeah. That's probably a very good idea. I'm more of like I just understand this thing. I take this transporter, which looks awesome. I plug it in and I plug it into the Ethernet, which is cool. Use a little bit of software and it connects to the Ethernet and I can instantly share folders with you. And it's going from my little device to your little device. And I don't need to worry about, cloud services or like, sort of, you know, like if I blow over some kind of some kind of a storage cap on their side.
And they even have, for people who are listening to Debug specifically, a developer API so you can start making your apps work with Transporter, you know, if that kind of system appeals to you.
They do. I've been looking into it. In fact, it's not on the Mac yet, but you may end up using it in Napkin, which is our app for Aged and Distilled, which is for concisely annotating image files to quickly share notes between designers and developers. One of the first requests we got was that ultimately all of our sharing options were public, whether they be through iCloud or through email or through whatever it is. So one of the first requests we got was that, you know, there's certain institutions that like to not share stuff outside. If we supported the file transporter API, we could totally deliver that in a very secure fashion. And that's important to me. Not just because they're a sponsor, I'm actually fascinated by that as somebody who's running a product.
Well, and the nice thing that they are doing because they're a sponsor is they're going to save our listeners 10% off their purchase up to $35 on any Transporter model using the code DEBUG10. That's DEBUG10. If you buy a product at www.filetransporterstore.com. It comes in 500 gigabytes, 1 terabyte, and 2 terabyte capacities. Also, if you want to roll your own, they have Transporter Sync, which provides the same functionality, but lets you, you know, basically you roll your own drive, and you can save $20. When you buy that at filetransporterstore.com using code DEBUG20.
So the Transporter Sync is, it looks like a little hockey puck, and you can plug in your USB drive of any capacity to it, and it'll act as the transporter does, which I think is a great idea.
Save time, save money, save privacy, save sanity. What's not to love?
Nothing. Vinay, there is nothing not to love about this product. Cool. Okay. So on a previous show, to be fair to myself, I was talking about web backend stuff, like Apache server stuff. But I said, you know, back in the day of classic Mac OS, nobody would go near the Mac for web development. And I felt stupid as soon as I said it because I immediately thought of BBEdit. But whatever, that wasn't where the conversation was going. Was the sort of the rise of HTML and the web one of the factors that really made BBEdit like a contender?
I think I could say without exaggeration that from the middle of 94 through 95, it was probably the factor.
Yeah.
Because from 93 to 94, my colleagues and I had done a pretty good job of capturing the imagination of the developer community. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until HTML came along and we had a plugin architecture and we got email from two different people in two different countries, one in the UK, one in England, and one in Spain. And each had written a set of plugins for helping to automate the authoring of HTML. And you know, the email came in and we looked at each other in the office and she said, HTML, I don't know what that is, but good for them. And the word just kept coming around, HTML this and HTML that. And mm-hmm. And people were buying BBEdit to edit HTML, and then people were buying Macs so that they could run BBEdit on them to do web development. And I think Unix was the leading platform for serving up, for serving up HTML. But that is even with some fully credible, web servers like Mac HTTP, which became WebStar.
Right.
And
now, wait, I know that was broadly used in the community.
Yeah.
Would you categorize it as, or characterize it as, you know, in the same class as an Apache or something?
I don't have as much experience with servers then. We were aware of a couple of them. There's one that Peter Lewis, the InterArchy developer, had done.
Yeah, smart guy.
And yeah, nice guy too. He's still around. He does Keyboard Maestro now. I think it's his core product.
Oh yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And Chuck Schotten, who wrote the I think it was Mac HTTP or Mac HTTPD. I can't ever keep them straight. That became WebStar, he's still around. And we were aware of those products, and I think we experimented with them, but like a lot of other folks, we were running Apache on whatever Unix machines we could get our hands on at the time. I think we had some old Solaris, we had some old Sun workstations running Solaris.
Yeah, because again, this is kind of before Linux was really a thing. I think FreeBSD was around. Some of the BSDs were. Linux hadn't really taken off yet.
That's right.
Yeah.
And But, you know, during the mid-90s, mid and late 90s, through the announcement of the next acquisitions, Macs were where it was at for doing web development.
Yeah, and you guys were sort of the place to go for that for a long time.
We were. We were the weapon of choice for doing what was primarily HTML work back then, but also some secondary stuff, Perl and other sorts of automation.
Yeah, CGI scripts and stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, and there was an explosion of visual editors in the mid to late 90s. NetObjects Fusion and Go Live and Dreamweaver. And there were Adobe PageMill and SiteMill. And they all had strengths and they all had weaknesses. And what we sort of did there was to end up being well positioned as either supporting products for when those just couldn't get the job done, or a companion product for handling certain parts of the job that couldn't be done.
Yeah. You know what? I tried all of those because I was in web development at the time, and I always went back to BBEdit because at the end of the day, I could make sure I got the code I wanted out of it. And the other ones all just produced really bad code in one way or another.
And that was a big thing at the time, right? Because bandwidth was nowhere near as great or as ubiquitous as today. And one thing that the visual editors all had in common was that they generated tremendous amounts of code.
And the worst was when people would not, you know, developers, but when people you worked with in Marcoms or stuff would paste Word into Dreamweaver or something, and you'd get you'd get tremendous amounts of Microsoft style junk in there. And BBEdit helped me clean that out.
Yeah, and you know, the Microsoft Word stuff was great if you were serving it up with IIS into Internet Explorer, but
not for
anyone else.
No.
There's kind of an interesting parallel here in that as the bare bones business gets stronger with the introduction of the HTML editing and all of that, Apple starts going through a bad time. Did that trouble you in any way? Like,
oh, greatly.
Yeah.
It troubled us because as you say, our business was getting stronger. We had a solid business. But back then Apple actually had a product, the, Internet Server Solution, not to be confused with the Apple Network Server, those giant IBM machines. Boxes, the Internet Server Solution was a Power Mac 8150 with a software bundle. And that bundle included, WebStar and BBEdit and PageMill and a few other things. And it was intended to be a web presence in a box. You buy this, you plug it in, you turn it on, you start building and serving the website. And so there were a lot of people who were doing web development on Macs, who were serving sites on Macs, and yet Apple was circling the drain.
Right.
And then in 97, Apple announces the deal with Next, and we all sort of look at each other and say, well, what are we going to do now?
Right. Yeah.
And we slept on it for a weekend, and we realized that, you know, the OS X, of course, we didn't know it as that back then, was to be 3 years away, 4 years away.
Yeah. Well, they promised sooner. I think they promised something like 2 years or 18 months or something.
Yeah. But shipped in
2001, I believe, March.
Yeah, March 24th, 2001, I think it was.
Yeah.
And we looked and we said, well, gee, here's this OS, and it's got, because we knew Next Step, right? We'd seen it, we'd used it.
Yeah.
We didn't have a Next machine, but we were familiar with them. And we knew that Next had had a mail client, which was very important to us because we were working on one then we hadn't shipped yet.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even considered that.
And they're, you know,
MailSmith, much loved.
That's right.
And missed, yeah.
And we said, well, you know, let's just keep doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Because this stuff isn't going to change overnight. And so we did, right? We finished Mailsmith and we shipped it. And we kept building BBEdit. And that turned out, I think, to have been the right thing to do, because we didn't suddenly have to redirect and re-engineer our business in midstream to do Windows software, which was something that not only did we not really want to do, but we didn't really know how to do.
Right.
We were all Mac experts of long standing. We knew how to use them. We knew how to write code for them. We knew how to bend the machine to our will in a way that would have just taken us years to have accomplished with a Windows machine.
Yeah. You'd have to come up from the ground up, which is
exactly.
Yeah. Now, so is that kind of a guiding business principle, sort of the discipline of that? Because, I mean, you mentioned previously that there was a bunch of visual editors coming out. Did you ever feel compelled to do a visual editor?
Nope.
Right. So basically it was just like, ah, screw it. BBEdit's the thing, and we're just going to keep doing it because people love it. And not BBEdit, but like you're that approach to doing products, like that.
In a sense, it was more a matter of, you know, we were aware of what our other folks were doing, right? We know, you know, we look at the landscape and we see, you know, well, here's NetObjects Fusion and here's Dreamweaver and here's GoLive and here's all this stuff. And they're clearly doing something with it, right? Nice. NetObjects got bought by IBM for $80 million, which in the mid-90s was real money.
Yeah. Well, it was the Java craze too, right?
It might have been, although I'm not sure how well that intersected.
I don't know if it did, but I know IBM was throwing a crap load of money at Java at that time.
They
They rebranded OS 2 to basically just be a Java platform.
Yep.
So
we always felt that it was a good idea to know what was going on in the world. We weren't going to just put our heads down and do what we were going to do. But certainly one of our guiding principles has been to try to avoid jumping on every single new thing just because it's the new thing. Mm-hmm. If something new comes along and it's something compelling in some way, sure. You know, we'll experiment with it. We'll be on it. Or if it's something that clearly presents an evolve or die situation, right? Like a platform change.
Right.
We've been through a bunch of those. We went from System 6 to System 7. We went from 68,000 to PowerPC, from PowerPC to Intel, from Classic OS to Mac OS. So, and those sorts of things don't really count, right? Because they're tectonic shifts, they're changes in the fundamental way the world works, and you either adapt to those or you're done. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's remarkably philosophical, because that's another thing I wanted to talk about, is that your company has weathered so many of these things. You know, certainly the jump from Classic to OS X, it's pretty big, because originally hadn't even announced Carbon. So that must have been a little bit scary.
Yeah. In the beginning, when I think it was Rhapsody, the prototype OS X came out.
Yeah.
We had the same reaction that I think a great many other Mac developers of the time did as well. And we looked at it and we said, well, that's really nice. But if we can't bring our current code base up on it, then no, because we're a small outfit. We don't have the resources to rewrite our products for this prototype untested OS when we don't know where it's going to go. So OS X really didn't become viable for us until Apple said, okay, so here's what we've got. We've got this transitional, and by transitional, they didn't mean temporary. By transitional, they meant intended to aid transition.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a distinctive point to make.
They said, we've got this Carbon API, we're calling it Carbon, and it's intended to bridge between legacy Mac code and the new world.
As I understand it, there was a forced help push for that.
Yep.
I think so, but I don't know for sure. The original notion came from one of the principal engineers at Adobe.
Oh, I'd buy that. Yeah.
A guy named Sean Parent, I think, came up with it.
Okay.
And the notion was to bridge between Blue, which was
classic
System 7, system Mac, Blue between Mac OS land, and Yellow, which was
what became Cocoa.
That's right. And I don't know if he wrote a whole bunch of prototype code to demonstrate it. I don't recall.
I think he championed it inside Apple and told them it was really important to do.
That's my understanding from what I've been told. Yeah. So I'm not going to credit him with coming up for the idea, but as I understand it, he was the sort of standard bearer for that.
Yeah. And for sure, it wouldn't have gone anywhere without somebody fairly heavy pushing it inside of Apple. I think that was, a very wise and insightful thing they did where, on the outside, you've got a lot of heavy hitters. You've got Adobe and you've got Microsoft, people who were making hundreds of dollars a year selling Mac software. Millions.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you made a low joke. I thought you made a joke on it just being on the low end. But yeah, there was millions of dollars.
They were making tremendous amounts of money selling Mac software. And on the one hand, they needed to keep their business going. And on the other hand, Apple needed the credibility.
Yeah.
They needed to be able to say, sure, Photoshop, no problem. Premiere, no problem. Microsoft Office, no problem. We've got it on this new OS. And so for them to have undertaken the effort to provide a compatible API was just a really good thing. I think it really did make OS X viable. And so when this came out, Apple started inviting developers to what they call kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew out there with my BB Edit source code, and I sat in a room with some other developers. There were some guys from Wolf from there, and there were some guys from other companies there. And there were engineers and engineering managers from Apple, developer tech support folks, developer relations, just there to say, okay, here's the latest SDK. Let's help you get your stuff to compile. Let's get it up and running. Did it crash on launch? What's going on? How can we help you?
Right. Seems like a room worth being in.
It was time well spent. And so that's where it came from. And so that was one of those tectonic shifts that we were on to early. And so we were... And this is the claim that we make, and I don't like to say things that I don't believe to be true, but this one is. We were the first product of our kind to be native on OS X.
Yeah.
We shipped just after OS X launch. I think it was April 2000. 2001. April 20th.
Less than a month after.
Was when the OS X version of BB Edit shipped. And that's because we had to.
Mm.
We had customers who needed that. And so we wanted to get there first. It really wasn't so much about bragging rights as wanting to get the job done.
Right. Well, it goes back to that semantic and the loss of faith in a tool thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't afford to do that.
Right.
Come back from it, yeah.
People need to know that they can depend on you to be there when the need is there.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other questions I had for you, because I'm not too sure about this, but Carbon was, everybody thinks of it now, certainly in terms of OS X, but Carbon also was sort of backported to the classic Mac OS in that they adjusted classic APIs or toolbox APIs to add the sort of a carbon layer to make it easier, again, to bridge from the old system to the new system. How was that experience? Because I haven't really actually talked to anybody about that.
Oh, we have a bird who just woke up from his nap. So Apple delivered something called Carbon Lib, which yes. was a this combination of an OS extension and a shared library that it got installed in the system folder, and applications would weak link against it, and there were headers that provided the Carbon Toolbox APIs. So you got things like Core Foundation was actually available on OS 9. Mm-hmm. And
which is a huge deal.
Yeah, it was. We didn't know how to use it very well back then, but we figured it out.
Sure.
Yeah. Again, you know, it was one of those very efficient ways to crash your app until you right. And there were so again with Carbon, there's the term gets kicked around a lot, but really Carbon was a collection of things. Carbon was a collection of what's called Carbon Core.
Right.
Which were the low-level file manager APIs, core services, what we call core services today, core foundation, and then the higher-level HI toolbox APIs. And those were all available as a unified API set, so you could write code against Carbon Lib, and it would run on build and run on 9, build and run on 10. There were some weirdnesses, right? There were some differences between 9 and 10.
Yeah, I bet. To be fair, these are very different operating systems.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
and they did a really terrific job.
Yeah.
For a while, our test load was double.
Yeah, that's going to – yeah. That kind of stinks, but
– So, you know, we weren't real sorry to leave behind OS 9.
Oh, that's interesting. So you were perfectly happy with the Brave New World.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Once the as the OS and the tools matured, I mean, we were still using CodeWarrior on OS 10.
Right.
And it was a little bit bumpy because when your debugger is GDB and you're trying to control it through what is basically a command line back channel from an IDE – it can get ugly.
Yeah.
But it worked. And developing on OS 10 was great because you protected memory alone was worth it.
Oh yeah. Didn't reboot.
No more reboots because of bugs. If you did something wrong that might have been a latent memory stomper on OS 9, you found out about it right away on OS 10. So OS 10 really did become an excellent platform, not just for deployment, but for test as well.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Around like the mid-90s, I was doing games, and it was just during the transition where Windows was becoming a real thing. And I think Windows 2000, Windows NT4 was the first one you could kind of write OpenGL code on. And it wouldn't totally just trash your system. and just do a hard reboot when you screwed something up. And man, that was like night and day, much better to work on.
Yeah.
Rather than like hard locking some Windows thing and booting every 30 minutes. And especially because, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners know, but like a memory trasher stinks to debug.
Yep.
And debugging it when it's just taking down your whole machine every time, that's just the worst.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I do miss some of the old tools. We did have some really good tools on OS 9. There was an old company, Devon Technologies.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of those guys.
Their initial product was called something called HeapQC. And it would catch things like over-releases, double disposes. Right? Disposing a handle twice or doing things. But the other thing they had, and it didn't get nearly as much popularity or visibility, but it was an outstanding product. It was called Spotlight, not to be confused with the OS service. Spotlight was a tool which you would drop your executable on it, and it would instrument the binary. it would actually modify the executable, so that when you ran it, it was a lot like in its day using Valgrind.
Oh yeah, cool.
But it predated Valgrind by, you know, at least a decade. Wow. But it was very similar in concept, where it would patch your binary, instrumenting it nine ways from Sunday, and you could find some really strange and obscure things. It would stop your program and say, you know, at this line of code, because it had all the source correspondence as well, mm-hmm. it would say, you're doing something that doesn't look right here.
Oh, that's interesting. Warning.
You're about to write to low memory. You're about to write into the space between two blocks of memory. You're scribbling this block's allocator header. You're passing bad arguments to this API call. A whole bunch of different things.
Oh, that's good.
I found was able to nail some really nasty and difficult to find bugs with Spotlight that would have just been impossible any other way.
That sounds like useful today.
Yeah. Valgrind was working for a while on 10.6, but isn't anymore. And the static analyzer, the Clang static analyzer, is really neat for finding stuff during the build phase. Mm-hmm. Right. And those were tools we didn't have back then. Valgrind is definitely better for what it does than Spotlight was even then. But the
truth is that the runtime environment of a piece of software is different from the statically understood system of the compiler, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in theory, there shouldn't be, but in practice,
sure. You know. Well, once you start getting user input into it, everything changes. Back to your original question. Yeah, we had Carbon Lib, and there were real differences between 9 and 10. And so, yeah, moving forward, we were able to build on 10, test on 10, deploy on 9. Of course, we had to test there too, because there were things that Carbon Lib would do differently.
Right.
There were some bugs that we had to deal with.
So as I said at the top of the show, Squarespace is our sponsor for this week. And Guy, I know you were a longtime developer. I worked in web development very, very briefly, but it was during the time when GeoCities started and MySpace started, and people thought that they could make their own websites, and bless them, they could not. It was not a good time for the web. But with Squarespace, I feel like even if you don't know how to code, if you don't know how to do CSS or design, you can finally get a very easy to make, very professional looking website very quickly with Squarespace.
Well, if you can't get an animated GIF, Starfield. Geospace. I'm not interested. But yes, I've played around with Squarespace a bit, actually, and I really like it. It's very easy to sort of change up and find nice and tasteful ways of presenting whatever kind of content you have, but still making it reasonably unique.
Yeah, it's responsive. They have a template system. All of it's professionally designed. You can change it all very easily. It's drag and drop. If you want to write your own code, they have a way for you to do that. But if you don't, you absolutely don't have to. 24/7 support with email and chat. And the nice thing is the plan started $8 a month. That includes a free domain name. You sign up for a year. And they can also do e-commerce. So if you want to sell something, like if you have a t-shirt or a product, anything you want, you can sell that through the site.
The e-commerce thing strikes me as being pretty interesting, because otherwise having to set up a site that can sell stuff is a huge pain in the ass. We could honestly do an entire show about the systems that a lot of sort of indie developers have come up with in order to sell their software over the site, or to order, you know, sell t-shirts or whatever. It's a huge pain in the ass, and the fact that Squarespace does a good job of this is, you know, it's super valuable service.
And no, yeah, they absolutely handle it for you. And the nice thing is for Debug listeners, they're doing an offer where you can get 10% off your first purchase and also show support for this show, for Debug. And the way you do that is you go to squarespace.com/debug, use the offer code Debug, that's D-E-B-U-G, when you sign up. And you can try it without a credit card. You can go in there, you can set up your site, you can play around with it, you can do everything you want to do with that free trial. And if you decide it's for you, then you give them the credit card, then you get the discount. It's a really humane, really user-friendly way of getting started.
So then things are happy. And then the switch to Intel comes along. Was that an issue for you guys?
Well, I think the bigger problem for us was the .com crash.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
Because, you know, when your business is built on the World Wide Web and servicing the needs of people who develop for it.
Yeah.
Post 9/11, and the .com crash together were just really kind of miserable because people stopped spending money.
Right.
People stopped growing. A lot of our customers literally went out of business.
And, yeah.
And they weren't around anymore to invest, and the ones who were left were holding onto their money very closely. So that was a big business shift for us. That, you know, with everyone else, we just sort of had to sort of tuck our heads down and hope for the best.
And it coincided with the platform shift.
Yes, indeed.
So there's like a ramp up in development costs and all kinds of stuff
during the OS 10 transition. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the shift to Intel was the next big platform shift. Mm-hmm. And because we had already ported to OS X and we were building and running on OS X, we were in remarkably good shape. And the switch to Intel gave us a chance to do something. And I think this is something we haven't really touched on yet. But the switch to Intel gave us a chance to do something which we had done a number of times over the lifetime of the product, and that is go through almost literally every line of code, every subsystem in the product.
Wow.
Because that happens when you have a platform shift. Yeah. When you're building with Lightspeed C for 68K, and then you switch to CodeWarrior, and you're building 68K or PowerPC, you've got a different compiler that finds different things. And when you switch APIs from Classic to Carbon Lib, you've got a whole different set of API rules. And so you end up by necessity crawling through every subsystem of your product looking for underbrush. And then you have to look at what's there, and you have to decide whether you throw it away completely or whether you just simply freshen it up, or you say, you look at this and you say, oh my God, that's not even right.
Yeah, this should never have worked. Right? Yeah.
you use a new compiler and you get a warning about something you never saw before. And you're like, holy cow, that's a bug.
Right.
And so that happened with Intel too.
Yeah.
The switch from Big Endian to Little Endian meant that we had to revisit some old binary data structures that we were writing to disk.
Yeah.
And clean those up and run all
of them. Do you do a lot of those?
Back in the day, we had done some.
Yeah, preferences and state caching and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. Preferences in particular, we had our own pref system because it predated CF preferences.
Yeah.
Some of our non-text document formats were binary.
Oh.
And some configuration data was binary. So there was some on the fly conversion, and there was some bug fixing that needed to be done. And that was it. And we had a developer evaluation system, which was an interesting beast. It was a PowerMac G5 case with an Intel motherboard in it.
Oh, right.
We had one of those.
You had one of those. Did you give it back or did you buy it?
We had to give it back.
Okay.
But
was that an option? Maybe not. I don't know.
I'm trying to recall. I seem to recall that.
I think none of us are supposed to be talking about those things, but whatever.
Probably. I think, you know, 10 years ago, I sort of doubt that anybody's going to be terribly upset. And I'm not going to tell anything super secret anyway.
Yeah.
I believe, as I recall, initially you had to buy the developer system.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, I think you could trade it back and get an iMac.
But then and then that's what happened with us. We got a letter from Apple that said, we want this back.
Right.
If you send it back, we'll give you an iMac.
Yeah.
An Intel iMac. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
So we got an Intel iMac out of the deal.
Well, it's a good deal. Looks prettier.
Yeah. all in all, it worked out pretty well. And so, yeah, it was really nice that we had early access to build and test on Intel. And it put us in a good position because we actually were able to release our Intel support in the form of a maintenance update.
Oh, that's great.
We didn't, let me think, when was that? Yeah, so in 2005, we shipped BBEdit 8.2 at the end of April. And that was actually an OS timed release because 10.4 shipped around then. And then about 3 months later, at the beginning of August, we shipped a maintenance update. There had been one or two in the meantime. And we shipped a maintenance update that just sort of magically added Intel support for people who were running those developer systems.
Oh, nice. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, well, I don't think that Apple had actually shipped Intel hardware at that point. Because didn't the first Intel Macs ship in 2006 as laptops?
Yes, I believe so. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we were out early because, it was one of those things where it's what our customers needed.
I'm trying to remember the first Intel release. It was 10.1, 10.4 something.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because I think it was like, maybe I'm nuts, but I think it could have been 10.4.1. They did like a minor bump that was Intel, which is kind of funny when you think about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. But it's nice that because that transition was handled incredibly smoothly.
Apple did a lot of hard work to make that happen.
Yeah.
I think Rosetta was a big part of the picture there.
Yeah. Did you guys run well under Rosetta? Or did you care?
We really, honestly, we didn't care because we had an Intel port.
Right. So the story for any customer would just be like, well, you know, we're rebooting. We're going Intel, so.
Yeah. 10.4.4, that was it. Yes, exactly. And that was the thing is, you know, if you were using an old version of BBEdit and you had some kind of problem under Rosetta, the answer was always going to be upgrade.
Right.
You'll get new features. It'll run so much faster and you won't regret it.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible thing to say too. Like, just it's in nobody's best interest to be putting your you know, a bunch of effort into debugging something on Rosetta. So
pretty much. And so yeah, we did the Intel version early in advance of hardware because we had developer customers, and that was kind of who we were serving there. We had developer customers who had those transition systems who needed, would like to have had BBEdit running natively.
Right.
And so we did that. And, you know, in fairness, sure, it also gave us additional test coverage.
Right, exactly.
Just in case there was something we missed when we were doing our port.
Yeah, which is a good thing for everybody.
Yep.
Not that I just want to iterate all the challenges, but next up is 32-bit to 64-bit.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting one because that's kind of a stealth transition.
Yeah. Well,
The reason
except
is
for the bit that really hurt, or imagine hurt, but.
Or still hurts.
Okay.
That's been more of a stealth transition because honestly, all of the systems out there that run 64-bit apps still run 32-bit apps, and the distinction between them is, except in I don't want to say extreme cases, but it kind of is when you start pushing the applications hard. Those distinctions are by and large invisible to the user, unless you know the user goes and looks and says, "Oh, this is a 64-bit process." So, for us, we're sort of in the middle of this transition because we're shipping a 32-bit app, but a great deal of the code inside of it has been overhauled or revisited or rewritten with the goal of making it 64-bit ready.
Okay. So one of the hurdling stones, I think this is kind of a, I don't know how to describe it. I'm looking for an adjective. This is not a great move by Apple in that they'd encourage people to get onto this HI toolbox thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, I'm sure you can describe it better, but for lack of a better description, it's a carbon side of the operating system view system that is very similar to the way NS views work on the Cocoa side. And I think the encouragement was there to sort of bring a closer relationship between the way carbon view handling was implemented and Cocoa view handling was implemented. I think.
I see what you're getting at. So, okay. So let's go back in time a little bit.
Okay.
So remember I mentioned CarbonLib and there was, and one of these components being the high level toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
So the HI toolbox, what it was called the HI view system is what you're thinking of.
Yeah.
And, that was something that was a formalized view and control system. I think it might have actually predated Cocoa.
All I know is when I look at it, they've got views, they've got a responder chain kind of idea.
Yeah.
It felt similar-ish, you know?
A lot of the same concepts are in the HI toolbox that are in Cocoa, or AppKit. So this was a 32-bit platform. And then in, was it 2006 when Apple was working on 10.5, working on Leopard?
Yeah.
That year's WWDC, they said, we're going 64-bit. There are going to be 64-bit frameworks for everybody. There's going to be a 64-bit app kit, and there's going to be a 64-bit HI toolbox. And here are prototype framework headers and frameworks for you to develop and debug with.
Yeah. And not only that, they had, at least the previous year as well, they'd been encouraging everybody to move on to HI Toolbox. Not the AppKit people, but.
Right. They had been encouraging more established folks who had established code bases to start using the HI toolbox.
Yeah.
And so we looked at that and we were sort of in the middle of a whole bunch of things and we looked at it and said, yeah, that's very nice. We have our own view system. It works great. Thanks very much.
Right.
And so we didn't stop and rewrite everything for HI toolbox. And when they said, 64-bit HI toolbox, we said, yeah, that looks very nice. We've got our own view system. It works great. Thanks very much. And so we didn't spend time rewriting for HI Toolbox for 64-bit either.
So this actually works out a little bit for you.
Well, yes and no.
Yeah. I thought you took the bait and switch, which would have stank. But
well, because the next year. When Apple said at WWDC, well, you know what we said about the 64-bit HI toolbox? Maybe not so much.
Right.
So start rewriting your code to use AppKit, and here are a couple of HI view bridge classes to help you embed
Coco into your
NS views into your HI toolbox view hierarchy. To which we said, we've got our own view system. Thanks very much. And
which at this point just seems like more and more kind of the same thing to do.
Well, yes and no, because
it's going to sting you down the road, I guess. But yeah.
Well, in fact, what caught us was the high DPI displays.
I was going to say, yeah.
In 2012, when Apple shipped those, and they basically broke everything in our imaging. And we said, well, we've got our own view system. So I spent that summer figuring out and asking a couple of stupid and or difficult questions that were helpfully and patiently answered by folks at Apple, figuring out how to migrate over to HI Toolbox or HI Views. So right. What I did basically was embed my view system in an HI view.
Oh, that's good. And you can, from there, you can
get the
scaling.
Well, the other part was I had to convert from legacy QuickDraw imaging, which we were still using, to Core Graphics.
Yeah. Which is a big leap.
That was a big leap, but it's done. Yeah. I did it. It was not how I would have wanted to spend my summer vacation, but it's done. And that in turn puts us in a good place because the Core Graphics being inside of my view system means that we're now separated. We've sort of abstracted the imaging model a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that now when I want to put things inside of an NS view, it's a much easier job than trying to go from all the way from legacy QuickDraw imaging to NS views and Core Graphics in one step.
Right. Which is a huge leap. Yeah, I just want to underscore the point that this app started on System 6. So these are the kind of difficulties you will have if you're lucky enough to have a piece of software that sticks around for this long.
That's right.
Yeah,
and these are the transitions that you have to make, that's what happens when you have a lot of old code, is parts and or holes of it need to get rewritten.
How did sandboxing affect you guys?
It hasn't yet.
Okay.
We've been looking at sandboxing and trying to, I won't say trying to avoid the issue, but trying to avoid the issue. Right? Because there are two big problems with sandboxing for us. The first is sort of what we do and how we do it, right. Which there's nothing underhanded about what we do or how we do it. It's just that the things we do, we scan the file system.
Yeah.
Discovering tags files for code indexing. When you run a multi-file search, we scan the file system, building a list of files to search, and then we read them all.
Well, you display a project list in the sidebar,
right? And that's got persistent references to files. We've got built-in FTP and SFTP, and the SFTP runs by running SSH in a shell. And we've got shell worksheets, which are an interactive process that runs a shell. And so there's a lot that we do. And that's even before you get to authenticated open and save or installing our command line tools, which just aren't going to happen in a sandboxed world. And we've really been unwilling to cut off those pieces to cut off those features because we would have to if we were sandboxed.
Yeah, well, I think that, that goes again towards what we were discussing earlier, where, all the visual editors in the world may come out, but you're just going to remain good at what you're going to do. And I think you kind of betray a trust in your audience or in your customers if you start having to drop features to fit in a sandboxing world and features that people may have just built their workflows around.
Yes, exactly. And so we have to look at that real carefully. And the other side of it is conversion and migration. You know, BB Edit's a very configurable tool, and we depend on, and our customers depend on being able to open a folder in their Finder and put stuff in there.
Right.
Do you consider the advent of the Mac App Store to be sort of a minor platform change as well?
Yeah, it's been a minor platform change, and in fact, we've had to make some compromises to be in the App Store. The build that's in the App Store can't do authenticated saves, and the build that's in the App Store can't install its own command line tools. And we have solutions for that. If you go look at our website, you'll find them. Or if you choose install command line tools from the App Store menu. But that's a compromise that we had to make, and our customers, our App Store customers bump into those. Mm-hmm.
I think you're a little bit lucky on that angle in that your customers are probably on the more likely to be cognizant of limitations of the App Store side, hopefully. So at least you can explain, like, look, we want to, it's an App Store thing.
Some of them are definitely aware, but the ones who are also the ones who are able to figure that out and go find the pieces they need from us.
Right.
The ones who aren't are the ones who write in, and they're simply irritated that it can't do whatever it is that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And they go away happy because we say, just download this and run it, and it'll install your tools for you. And you'll be fine.
Yeah, but it's still that extra hurdle that nobody really wants to have to leap.
Right. And it compromises the customer experience, and we kinda hate that.
Yeah. And this is in the wake of Panic announcing last week that Coda 2 is gonna be pulled from the App Store.
That's right.
They can't support it. With a very classically Panic, nicely written, nicely worded letter saying that it's not Apple's problem or Apple's fault. Because they tried to help them, but it's just they can't find the right trade-off to where the features go and where they can't.
Right, exactly. And it's a trade-off that no developer really wants to face, and frequently it's a set of trade-offs with no viable way out, which I think is why Panic did what they did.
Yeah.
You know, because even when you can get a temporary entitlement for something, and even when Apple says, all you have to do is put up a save panel asking the user where they want this.
Yeah, it's a horrible UI.
Right. And I completely understand and respect Panic saying, that's just not a place we want to take our product right now.
Yeah, no, I understand that too. I also kind of do understand Apple's point of view. As frustrated as a developer, I get frustrated by it. But I can kind of see what they're trying to do.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a sort of a difficult set of considerations, and they really do work at cross purposes to each other. The trade-off between security and convenience usability is one that goes back to the days of when PGP was new.
Right. Yeah. I think there's a lot of that in sort of the history and sort of at least all of the transitions we've discussed, is that there is this sort of tectonic plate grading between sort of the third party developers and Apple. Ultimately, I think everybody just wants a good outcome. But what that means in the specifics are kind of hard. Like Apple doesn't think Apple probably when they ditched this 64-bit HI toolbox probably knew that they were going to do Retina and decided they didn't want to double the workload and confuse everything. So, you end up with this crazy situation where some people just end up having to do a lot of work. Some people get it easy. So I think it's difficult to always have best outcomes for the platform provider and third party people that rely on that platform.
It can be. Let me think for a moment about how to phrase this. So,
I
when I look at the 64-bit toolbox, 64-bit HI toolbox situation, something that I know some people are still bitter about.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so long ago.
Yeah.
That it's hard to imagine that Apple saw Retina coming that far away.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I guess that was 2006, right? So
thereabouts. Or
yeah, so I'm stretching. I'm reaching on that one for sure. Yeah.
And so my guess is that was simply a resource allocation decision. Mm-hmm. Because the HI Toolbox team that I met at that year was 5 people. And I think that was a resource allocation decision. And Apple said, you know, why don't we put these 5 people to work on something that's ultimately going to be more useful for us long term than this set of APIs that we really don't even want people to be using anymore.
Right.
Because that was the thing, right? By the mid 2000s, it was pretty clear that Apple really wanted developers to be using AppKit and only AppKit.
Yeah.
And again, I don't fault that. And this is going to dovetail into my second point about 2 seconds. The relationship between Apple and developers really depends a great deal on Apple's own condition. Mm-hmm. We have known for so many years that Apple will act in their own strategic interests. And if there is a developer whose work is aligned with Apple's strategic interests, well, that's terrific.
Yeah.
And I say that because we were one of those developers in the mid-90s. The web was very important to Apple. They wanted to be the platform. Mm-hmm. That folks use, and they were for many years, were the platform of the web when it came to the production side.
Yeah.
And when you don't align with their strategic interests, it really doesn't much matter what Apple does. What you do doesn't matter too much to Apple.
Yeah.
Because you can do as you think is best, and if that furthers your business as a developer, well, that's good, right? Because, you know, every developer's making money is never bad.
Right. Yeah.
But Apple isn't going to rise and fall on what you do as a developer. And so their first priority is always going to be their strategic interest.
Yeah, I've come to accept that truth into my life in a way that's like, you know, they're doing their thing. And if I can fit in some way that's beneficial to me then that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, well, I'm going to have to, you're going to have to make your own decisions and try to figure out what to do.
That's right. I don't think
bent out of shape and being angry, it helps any business, really. On a personal level, you can be bummed out. But, I mean, that's different than you should expect to get squashed if you know the giant rolls over from time to time.
You want to avoid being a grape in the path of the steamroller of progress.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Nicely put.
Yeah.
Because the steamroller just isn't going to notice.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it's one thing to be staring at this code that I have to rewrite because it needs to be 64-bit ready and sort of slumping my shoulders and saying, oh, so many other things I'd rather be doing right now than this. And you can look at the App Store and you can look at the restrictions that get put on submissions, and you can look at sandboxing and look at what a giant inconvenience it is. In many respects, really it is. But it's it's really self-destructive to personalize it.
Right. Yeah.
And to say, you know, I hate Apple for doing this. It's like, no.
Right. No, I totally agree. Not only that.
It doesn't make it less a nuisance.
Right. Exactly. A, it doesn't fix your problem. B, I bet you there's a bunch of people in Apple who are sympathetic to your cause and would say, like, yeah, that really sucks. Yep. But, you know, ultimately.
It's not personal.
It's not personal, and you're definitely not going to change anything by, you know, getting all bent out of shape on it.
Yeah, and I remember at the developers conference where they introduced sandboxing, and I wanted,
I was going to bring this up because I was in that little huddle with you.
That's right, over in the labs.
Oh, I missed it.
Okay. Well, there was a hallway huddle, right?
One big thing was that sandboxing said it was going to block Apple events.
Yeah.
And I happen to know that your app is, because you did the right thing by Apple in the 90s, your app works internally with a bunch of Apple events because it's Apple recordable. It's script recordable, right?
That's right. It
was at some point. So,
and I think intra application events would have worked. But as described, blocking Apple events between applications and Apple events for scripting would have just really blown a giant hole in everything. And yes, I remember that hallway huddle where I think two of the physically largest people in the industry, me and Greg Hockenberry.
Yeah, you were both there looking very concerned about this.
Right. But in the security lab, I went over to a couple of the security engineers who were working on this stuff, and I introduced myself. And the instant reaction it said, they said, oh, yeah, we've been talking about you. Because they knew. Right?
Yeah.
They knew that what they were doing was going to break the operating model for a lot of tools, not just us, right? But us and Panic and even Xcode, really.
Yeah.
Of course, Xcode's not sandboxed.
Yeah.
But in any case, the point being that, as you say, inside of Apple, there are folks who are very much aware of the effect they're having.
Yeah, and especially those sandboxing teams.
Yes.
Everybody I've spoken to on that has been very aware and kind of apologetic. And I can't hold a personal gripe against any of them because I think they're smart people. They're just, it's a difficult thing to do.
They have to do what they have to do, and they understand the implications, and they don't feel good about it when they hear that somebody is getting broken because of what they do.
So not to, I know we're going long here, but not to end on a long note or a low note. So we've covered sort of the grand history of the company. A lot of competing products have come and gone, and you guys are still sticking it out. Is there a key to that, or is it just this tenacious thing, or is it just kind of just focusing on the product and keep making decisions the way you've been making decisions?
I think the key thing there is that we have always tried to take the long view. And the long view includes engineering for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to the implementation decisions we make, the technologies we adopt, what we choose to support when it comes to what's new and interesting, the way we interact with our customers is something that we take the long view with.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we do. And, you know, the risk is that you look too far down the road and end up tripping over your own 2 feet. So there's a balance there, right? You've got to be flexible, but you always have to keep the long game in mind. And so there's that. There is a certain amount of tenacity in terms of, you know, right now I've got to do this and I'm not letting go until it's done.
Nice.
there's an aspect of creation or creativeness. Is that even a word?
Creativity.
Creativity. Thank you.
Well, the nice thing about that word is you can make up whatever you want.
Right. And so I get to be creative, and as long as I get to be creative, there will always be something new to dream up. And that could be a customer request that forms the seed of something new and interesting. That could be a new idea that I wake up with in the middle of the night. That could be a new way of doing something that we've done for the past 20 years. And I just look at that and I say, you know what? We've done it this way for the past 20 years, but it's time for a fresh look, because just because it's been that way forever doesn't mean it has to stay that way forever. Right. So I think there really is a blend of things that go into building a product and building a company for the long haul.
Does Tech Strangler fit into that strategy as well? Is that sort of an investment in the long-term growth of PBEdit?
It is, because what Tech Strangler does is it puts our work in front of a great many people, which you can do when you've got a product that doesn't have to be paid for.
I know a lot of people who aren't what I would call power PBEdit users, who kind of shun away from the price, but they try Tech Strangler and either they run into something they'd rather have, or they just like it so much they kind of want to throw money at you, and so they get PBEdit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we see that as well. And you know, pricing is always tricky, especially in this day and age. And that's, again, from the business side, one of the less fun things that has come from the modern economy is somehow the price structure for applications has been severely depressed.
Well, you still charge $50 for PBEdit in the App Store.
We do.
Yeah, which, good on you. I mean, I got an app up there for $40. So,
excellent.
Yes, I think. Let's stick together, brother.
And eventually folks figure it out. And
yeah.
Sometimes you need to kind of prod them and not in a really heavy-handed way. But the question that I always ask when somebody complains about the price is, well, how much do you charge for billable hours?
Right.
Or how does the price of this product, whose price you're complaining about, and because it's not necessarily mine, right?
Right.
Somebody might say, oh, $40 for Kaleidoscope or whatever it was. I forget what the most recent example was. You know, I'm not paying that for a diff app. And I'm thinking, really? Yeah. And I've actually said this, you know, how much does the product cost relative to how much time will it save you?
Right.
What's the value versus cost thing again? And a lot of markets, they get commoditized, but there's almost always a premium layer on top where people have said, this is worth it because XYZ.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Certainly selling to the professional set has that cachet, at least.
And it's an easy argument. It's an easy argument to say. Sometimes you can get a little reductionist about it. You can say, you make your living selling work that you use this product to make. Why are you complaining about the price of it?
Right. Yeah. For Napkin, the app that we sell for $40,
should be free 1-star.
Go put that on the thing with your real name. That would be awesome. It's the best endorsement. we get very little complaining about the actual price. We do get a bit. We get a lot more people asking for a demo version, which we haven't done because of iCloud gobbledygook.
Yeah.
But we will eventually get there. Do you think that maybe Tech Strangler sets you up for a bit more criticism on the pricing point?
I don't think so. And we haven't really seen it because the differences between PBEdit and Tech Strangler are really pretty clearly defined.
Yeah.
And so the value proposition for PBEdit is pretty clearly drawn, and there is a demo version of PBEdit, though not in the App Store.
Right.
So,
yeah. So, yeah.
And yeah, and that's sort of one of the things, right? At this price level, $40, $50, you have to offer a demo version because people expect it.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe 10 years ago, somebody would drop $40 or $50 without even thinking about it. Now they very much want a try before you buy.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a very reasonable request. It's common, but it's totally reasonable. $40 is only $40, but in the scheme of like the sea or software that's out there, I want them to know that they're going to get something that's worth $40, you know?
Sure. I mean, doing a demo version, I don't think would hurt.
Yeah.
But I don't know, $40. If I looked at a product and it had been reviewed well by people and it looked like it did what I needed, I would drop $20. I would drop $40 on it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking 20 because I recently did that. I spent $20 on something without even thinking about it because of that. It looked like it was what I needed. Yeah. And what was it now? I don't remember.
Well, that thing is, it's apps for people for whom time is more valuable than money.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think Rich and I may skew a little bit on the upside of that because we do this for a living.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty happy to buy. I think I bought like 5 copies of Acorn over the years. And at one point I had the source code and I still bought a copy. So that was dumb. But
it might have been an upgrade to Acorn now that I think of it.
Yeah.
Something reasonably recent.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it just
– right.
Why wouldn't I?
Exactly.
And yeah, Renee, absolutely. There is a set of there is a type of person. There's a set of people who values time above money. And I'd like to see more people making that trade-off, not just because it's in my personal interest, but also because I think that it reflects an attitude which is generally beneficial.
Well, so I hear it described that way a lot, where people value time over money. Where people value money over time, whatever. I think the issue is that if you can prove to them that whatever time they spend with your application will make back more money than they would have made otherwise, then you have a very compelling case.
Mm-hmm.
I think if your argument is just that, like, well, you know, I like my free time more than my money, that has the problem that it sounds like coming off as like elitist or that you've got a lot of money to throw around. And that's not the argument at all.
Right.
The argument is like, use your time to make the most money.
I mean, everything's got a cost, right? So you're either paying with money, you're paying with data or attention, you're paying with time, and you've got to figure out what's more important to you, what you can least afford to pay with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, we can go on for like a whole nother show about just this topic. You know what? And we didn't even cover all of the other apps that you work on.
It's an excuse to get Rich back.
Yeah, well, yeah, you can't handle Rich.
Well, as long as it's worth everyone's time.
Oh, it's definitely worth everybody's time, yeah. I think MailSmith alone like saved a bunch of people a crap load of time.
Oh, goodness.
Which, yeah, there's another topic.
I'm still running it.
Are you?
I am. I have it building from source with Xcode 5.1, and I have it's my daily driver email client.
You know.
Which is a problem because I don't have the time or money to do IMAP support, but that's neither here nor there.
IMAP is kind of crazy. It's still pop only?
Yep.
Yeah. That was a nice simple – those were the simple days. Yep. When I started having more than one device, I started liking IMAP.
And that's really the issue is you really do need IMAP these days.
But for certain accounts, like a work account where I just go through like notifications for CVS, whatever the hell, like get check-ins or anything like that, that would be perfect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You should wait for like a good anniversary and just release it for like $300.
Anniversary edition.
Oh boy.
Make it
signed and numbered.
Rich, where can people find you on Twitter or anywhere?
I am on Twitter under my last name, Siegel.
With a great icon, I gotta add.
That's the old Ice View Pascal icon. Yeah. And that's my primary online presence. We have the company website. I have a Tumblr that I update once in a blue moon, so don't go looking for it.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it was a blast. I had a really good time. A good rumble through history. And it's interesting because I think I've tended to talk to more Next guys than old Apple guys. I think the old Apple guys are just finally starting to trust me now. 10 years later.
Earned your cred.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Or at least they've got other people to argue with now.
You speak the language very well, I must say.
Well, you know, I do my homework. It's been great. Thank you very much. Yeah, I don't know. I'll find an excuse to have you on again. Because we've been actually planning this for like over a year.
I know. We've been trying to make it happen for so long, and I'm glad that it finally did. And
yeah, me too.
And yeah, if you come up with an excuse to have me back, well, I promise I will be much quicker about it.
Well, we'll try to get you and Hockenberry on. You can just argue about. We can make you fight like Godzilla style or something.
The kaiju episode.
Thanks again, Rich. Thanks again, Squarespace. Remember to visit squarespace.com/debug and use offer code debug to save 10% off. A great website, a great web starts now.